Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. A Love Supreme recorded on this day, December 1964. And it became one of those albums that changed the nature of music and in many ways changed the nature of culture in America. And John Coltrane was at the heart of that, obviously. Came out, released by Impulse Records in the winter of 85. I think it was February of 85 when the record first came out. And I remember being a young guy at that point. And getting that album in when I was suspended from school. And I went to the record store, and there was this album by John Coltrane I picked up because I love Coltrane. And it began that my lifelong I was already in love with Coltrane from the days of his earlier music in the late 50s and early 60s. So we are now going to gather a group of people who really understand this music and understand him to talk about why this was such a powerful piece of music, what he meant for America and for music, and more. We have in our studio two of our great announcers here in WEAA. Doc Manning is with us, good friend, host of The Tradition. In the Tradition, WEA 8.9 FM, heard every Monday night here. Good to have you back in the studio, Doc.
Thank you, Mark.
My good friend Robert Shaheed, host of the Baltimore Blend and longtime Baltimore musician and drummer in the house.
Good to have you here, Rob. Good morning, Mark Steiner. Pleasure to be with
and
you.
We are on, and calling in, by the way, is now Nasir Abadeh, who teaches jazz percussion at the jazz studio at the Peabody. And Nasir, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Yes, thank you so much. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Yeah. And we are honored to have with us for the first part of our program, Lewis Porter, jazz pianist, composer, professor of music at Rutgers University, founder of the master's program in jazz history and research, and author of many books, including John Coltrane, His Life and Music. And Lewis Porter, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's my pleasure, friend. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So, and folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to me here at talk@steinershow.org, tweet me at Mark Steiner. You can log on to our Facebook pages, but join us, 410-319-8888. Let me start, Lewis. Let me start just for our listeners to understand this. Your own sojourn and love with John Coltrane from your dissertation on, I mean, and what drew you to this artist to begin with?
Well, I have to say I knew since the age of 14 that I wanted to be a professional jazz musician. But at that age, when I heard Coltrane's music, you know, it's kind of deep stuff, and I liked it, but I can't say I quite got it. You know, Sonny Rollins I got right away, Coleman Hawkins right away. But it was actually in my 20s that it just started to grow on me gradually. And then one day when I was listening to A Love Supreme, by this time I was already about 28, I was listening to it probably for the 50th time, I heard what he was doing, and I heard, especially in the last movement, that he was reading the words of his poem instrumentally on the saxophone. And that moved me so much. I found it so exciting that I decided then and there that I wanted to write something about Coltrane.
And what's interesting, what you just said, many people don't know this, and I remember I discovered it, the poem that he wrote that became Love Supreme. And it's his homage to what his belief in God and a super spirit were, not the traditional kind of Christian God or monotheistic God, but his own notion of what's larger out there for all of us. And that was a pretty powerful piece he wrote. And when you read that, you can begin to see the connection between that and Love Supreme.
Absolutely. Because he does it as kind of, I don't know, I guess today we might call it an interfaith approach. I mean, there's no mention of anything other than God. There's no mention of anything that would restricted to a particular religion. And sure enough, it was only about a year after this that he was quoted in the liner notes to Meditation saying, "I believe in all religions." And I think that he really meant that.
Gentlemen.
Yeah. Well, I certainly Robert agree Shaheed. With him. I think that A Love Supreme, personally, one of those compositions, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, there was an atmosphere among musicians that we used to have listening sessions, and you'd listen to a new release, and then you'd come out and comment about it, and then you'd try to play some of it. For A Love Supreme, when it came out, I remember many of us gathering in the stereo room listening. In stereo, it was only two speakers.
Yeah.
Listening to Love Supreme, and afterwards nobody had anything to say.
Ah.
It was just that spiritual piece that everybody, and one of the things that was true also in Coltrane's concerts was that when you listened to his music, you actually felt his ascension into greater and greater excellence as a result of his appreciation of a supreme being. So Love Supreme was that testimony that impressed us all.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that, because for me,
when I got to Love Supreme, I got it from the top down, from his music, from the top, not from the beginning. And also, I got it later, you know, because I had Hendrix, I had everything else, but I had to listen to Coltrane for some reason because it was more like a folklore during that time with Miles Davis and all those guys. So I had to listen to that, and when I heard it, I heard everything. It just like we're doing now, the ease of it, the introduction to it, and what it said to me. It was a cleansing episode. It was a pivotal time, and I listened to what we listened to music. He's changed everything what we did, but it was a level of consciousness through those that suite, you know. And he talked about everything he went through and how he got to that point within that suite. I mean, if you listen to it, like Mr. Porter was saying, if you listen to it, everything came out of it. Everything came out of that recording. It really got to me that way. And after I remember hearing something that he, I don't know if it's true or not, that after he wrote all this, but he came downstairs, he said, I'm finished. And I don't know if he said it to his wife or not. But I think it's something to that effect. And then he went forth. Yeah.
Lewis, is that how the story went?
That's a story that his late wife Alice told, absolutely, when they were living in their last house, which was in Huntington, Long Island. Mm. And, you know, one of the amazing things about this album is that, unlike most of his other albums, he knew that it was important. He made it very clear that this was special for him. First of all, it's the only album he ever made that he did his own liner notes for. He never did that. He commissioned a friend of his to do a drawing of him for the insert. He chose the photo that was featured on the outside of the album. It actually wasn't, that photo wasn't actually made for the album. It already existed, but he said, I like that photo. I want it on the album. So it was clear that he really conceived of this as something special. He knew it wasn't just another album of tunes, you know.
And Nasir, I'm glad you could call in. And one of the things I was thinking about, I want to focus just for a minute, because George is going to be with us for the next 10 minutes or so, and I want to get Lewis, excuse me, going to be with us for the next 10 minutes or so, is that one of the things here about this piece is that it was as if this was the moment that Coltrane also decided to break loose. That a lot was going on in society. I mean, he wasn't overtly political in the sense he was at demonstrations, but he was a deeply conscious man of what was going on around him, growing up in the South, knowing what was happening around him. And this is almost as if the chains were unleashed in 1965, socially and politically, Lewis, that allowed him, that he took part in, and it was unleashing his music was the same thing.
Exactly. Someone was just asking me yesterday, what is the connection in Coltrane between politics and music? Because he didn't make it in a detailed way. In other words, he didn't say, I'm voting for so-and-so, or I'm a member of such political party. But he made it very clear in his music, in the titles of his pieces, in his general attitude to things, and in things he said about interviews, that he felt very involved in the peace movement. He felt very involved in the civil rights movement.
Right.
And that he did feel that his music was part of that.
And I think we have to remember...
That context, this is the same year that Malcolm X had left the Nation of Islam earlier that year. This is the same year of the Ballad of the Bullet speech. It was the president, Lyndon Johnson, had declared a lot of things that were popular, but quite a few things that weren't. So all of this in context was Love Supreme seemed to epitomized the whole nation's striving towards some kind of peace and resolution and appreciation of some higher goal for us all.
Yeah. He said something to the effect that there are good forces and there are bad forces, okay? Something like this. This is what Train said. I remember reading it. And he said that I want to be a force for good. I think it was something like that. You know, I think that sums a lot of it up. Do you think?
I agree. Mm.
Nasir, you want to jump? Nasir, we haven't heard from you. I'm sorry. Why don't you jump in?
Sorry. Are you speaking to me?
Yes.
Okay. What was your question?
Well, there was no question. We were talking about what the power of this moment meant. And I think his sound, in this particular piece we're hearing right now, Sam, he's going to break out in a minute or two here.
For me, John Coltrane, and especially A Love Supreme, represented the point where the music was placed in its proper context. In other words, it's a spiritual music, and John Coltrane seemed to me at the time to be concerned with his spiritual commitment to the music as well as what he felt about the Creator, about God. And so for me, when I first heard the piece, I was in. I bought in immediately because I was a teenager. And so that music at the time in the 60s, it represented protest music. It was protest music. And so it was a way of letting folks know that the music up until that point was created and performed in places where illicit things went on. You had alcohol, you had all kinds of drugs going on, all kinds of things. But at that point, for me, what it represented was I heard the music of ancient Egypt in that at first. Yeah. I first heard that piece. I heard the music of ancient Egypt. I heard the voices of the angels, and so my peers and I, we did the same thing. We would listen to music, and we would comment on it on the new albums that came out. But this one, when I first heard it, I heard the conviction of John Coltrane. Yeah. I read his poem, right. And I also heard the vitality, the vitality that was in the music, and the commitment from all the musicians towards this project. And then also, I had an opportunity as a teenager to once see John Coltrane, but I couldn't get in the club, so I could see him through a window.
I must have been
16. I wasn't old enough to get into the club. Mm. But I saw him, and my friends and I, it was a big picture window, and they would open the curtains so that we could see, because we weren't old enough to get in.
Lewis, before you have to run, I want to bring you in on this one particular piece. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about and reading some stuff that you've written and some other things around as well. And there was an interesting comparison I saw here. And the comparison had to do with John Coltrane's Love Supreme as being the strange and new piece for most people to hear, mm-hmm. exploding out. And compared to 200 years before with Beethoven and the Eroica Symphony, mm-hmm. also kind of stretching mm-hmm. bounds of music mm-hmm. and where society was going.
Absolutely. And it's incredible how that album spoke to people. I mean, that album is super intense. It's super uncompromising. It's adventurous. It's powerful. And it was a hit. I mean, that album sold, we think, because it's hard to get exact counts, about 500,000 the first year when it came out in 1965, of course, it was recorded December 9th and 10th of 64, about 500,000, which makes it one of the best-selling jazz recordings of all time, one of the 10 best-selling. And it's kind of incredible because today, I could be wrong, but I can't imagine an album like that selling 500,000. There's something about the way it spoke to the time, the way it
drew right. people
in, and what people were looking in at that time, and what they were looking to get out of a recording and out of a piece of music.
I agree with you totally. And I might want to add that the times, the turbulent times of those 60s when this was recorded, pretty much mirror the times we're in today, where you're looking for some kind of resolution. So the music is not just relevant for the time that it was recorded back in 1964 in December. It's actually still relevant. You can play John Coltrane's Love Supreme today in an audience of listeners, and the same impact, that same spiritual feeling, that same sense that you are listening to something that is a monumental recording, a performance that is second to none. That still is to the day. In fact, there are many tenor players still trying to play like that.
Let's talk about this quartet. We'll come back to the other issues. Do you want to say something,
yeah,
Doc? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, what he did with all that. You remember you guys were talking about the relevancy in the historic times. You mentioned Beethoven. Well, it's sort of like, you know, John Coltrane loved Stravinsky, and he did all because his composition work points that out. You know, he'll say something about it. But the thing about it is that when you remember Stravinsky writes a passage, there was a ride. I think it was a ride that took place when he introduced that with 1920 or something like that. And then you see the impact of what Byrd, you know, how it changed things. Then you get to Coltrane, and it's as if Coltrane, when you hear the constant march with Elvin Jones on drums and the bass and that deep, warm feeling, but determined, it's sort of like he's carrying the world on his shoulders. And, you know what I mean? After everything that took place during that particular time in history. You know?
And correct me if I'm wrong, but let's not forget that Coltrane didn't come in here with a manuscript for his group. They had achieved a certain level of empathy between Elvin Jones and Jimmy Garrison.
Remember, he said it was telepathic?
It's just a small exactly. sheet of paper, a little template for them to follow. Yeah. And they did this in one take.
It's something that he learned from Miles, actually, that Miles said to him, you know, you're going to get fresher performances if you don't have too much of it written down. Let them come up with stuff. And that is, he took that lesson to heart, and that's why he decided to come in with just a couple of little ideas, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to run because I'm doing an interview on Huffington Post.
Yes, we heard about that. Okay. Right.
All right.
But, I want to say, is Doc Manning still on there?
He certainly is.
Yes, yes, sir.
I just want to say my good friend Janet Lawson said hi.
She's oh, my God. Work. Okay, yeah. She's doing okay?
Yeah, she's doing great. She's okay. She's here in Manhattan.
All right.
So it's great to talk with you gentlemen to celebrate this great album, and I hope to see you again soon.
Me okay. too.
You will. You
Thank
will.
You so much, Louis, for joining us.
Thanks, Louis.
Louis Porter, one of the great professors of music and jazz in our country and jazz historians, created the master's program in jazz history at Rutgers and author, of course, of many books, including John Coltrane, His Life and Music. We're still with our other incredible guests here, Robert Shaheed and Nasir Abade and Doc Manning joining us here in studio. And you at 410-319-8888. And we did talk to McCoy Tyner. He was going to join us here today. Yeah. He's the last living member of that quartet.
His birthday is tomorrow.
It's tomorrow, but he doesn't do mornings. So we have to get him another day.
Well, you know, they had the lights down in the studio during this recording of Love Supreme. The atmosphere and everything was reflected. So I guess McCoy was at his best.
Nasir, go ahead.
Go ahead, Nasir. I'm sorry.
Very briefly, I had the opportunity and privilege to play this suite, A Love Supreme, for the first time in my life. I played the music, maybe one song from the suite here and there with other bands, but this particular time, this last opportunity was September 28th, this past September 28th, I did the entire suite with noted saxophone player and scholar Andrew White.
He transcripted, I suppose, everything.
Yeah, he transcripted, and we performed it on September 28th at the Seventh-day Adventist University. And it was packed. And but the way he wanted us to play this was he wanted us to bring the same vitality to the stage on that day. And all I could do was just I got stronger as I went along because Andrew's such a strong and committed player. But I do appreciate having the opportunity to play this music with the same, and I brought the same intention to the music that I thought John brought, and that is that the music is a means of reaching a higher spiritual consciousness through the music, and also stating that the music and the musician and creation is one.
And on that incredibly powerful
Thanks
note,
lot,
we're going to take a very short break and come right back with our guest, continue our conversation with Love Supreme. This is the greatest jazz station in Baltimore, Maryland, in the state of Maryland, one of the best in the country.
I agree.
I know you all listen to it, so join us here at 410-319-8888. Your own thoughts. We'll be right back. Favorite pieces on this is the first part of Love Supreme, acknowledgement, and when they chanted Love, he chanted Love Supreme and dubbed it in over and over again.
It's like a song.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the great John Coltrane here with Doc Manning, who is host of In the Tradition here on WEAA 88.9 FM every Monday night from 8 to midnight.
Yeah.
to midnight. And Robert Shahid, who used to play 8 to midnight, now he gets up early, host of Baltimore Blend on WEAA, and longtime musician and drummer, noted drummer. And
don't say that in the presence of Nasser Abadie.
Well, we say, and another noted drummer, Nasser
he's
Abadie.
He's the king of the drummers.
Who is the studio, everybody. So, two drummers in the house.
I'm happy to be here this morning with you, gentlemen.
Oh, it's a privilege to be with you. Man. You know, Nasser, I was mentioning off mic, and you may want to dispute me on this, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway.
Go ahead.
One of the beauties of the Love Supreme, not to take away from John Coltrane, because that is the beauty of Love Supreme, but one of the things that seems to be a confluence of excellence was the fact that he recorded it with Rudy Van Gelder. Rudy Van Gelder, during that recording time, was able to capture the drums and the instruments, probably, in my opinion, better than any other recording company out there, any other engineer at that time. And I think that by having the fortunate confluence of those excellent people together helps us to get the real sound that a Love Supreme would be. Rudy Van Gelder really captured what Coltrane and the ensemble were playing that day.
Well, I can agree with you on that. And also, I would add that I had the pleasure of working with Rudy on a project or two projects that I did with late trumpeter Malachi Thomas.
Oh, yes.
And we were in the studio with Rudy at his studio in New Jersey, and his commitment to the music and capturing it and presenting it, he was almost genius in the way that he could capture the music and then make it bigger than it actually is, or bigger, as big as it should be.
I think I agree.
Yes, that's a better way to state it. And but yeah, Rudy and Rudy was very particular and meticulous to the point where if you were not, for instance, I remember being in the studio one time and I sat down to the piano to play it, and he immediately stopped me from playing the piano.
Oh, yes.
Everything he touched, he had white gloves on.
He wouldn't touch his microphones without gloves.
That's right. But so you couldn't touch anything. He had to touch it. So he's very meticulous.
Yeah. And I think that's a blessing for us all, because to come and appreciate John Coltrane as John Coltrane wanted that sound to sound, I think that Rudy Van Gelder helped him to achieve that.
Interesting.
You just go and check out historically, check out all of Rudy's recordings.
Oh, yes.
The first thing you know,
I think as a drummer, I don't know of any other recordings out there that have been recorded so well as the drums of Art Blakey or Tony Williams when Rudy Van Gelder did.
And that full and that warmness with it too.
Yeah.
Did he co-write "It's a Wonderful World"?
Who, Rudy Van Gelder?
Yeah,
I can't.
Or Bob Teal, one of the two. I forgot.
I think it was Bob Teal.
Okay. Yeah. But it's one of those things where, you know, you sit down and listen to the music. It is so expansive. I mean, when you're dealing with Love Supreme, the movements, everything is sort of is logical. The development of it. I mean, how it ends. But he speaks to everything he went through. You could hear that in this one thing. Mm-hmm. And when he wanted to go away from regular constraints of music and let's say just he just stepped outside of it. That's what made it so interesting to me.
A couple of things I want to talk about with his life and his work and these different sets that you all think, because you are the brilliance of jazz here in the studio, not me. I'm just kind of play around the edges, but. You know, one of the things, I was reading a piece by, I remember this piece from a guy named Frank Kafsky, who was a jazz writer back in the day. And he wrote this book, Black Nationalism, A Revolution in Music, back in 1970.
Right.
And one of the things he talked about here was, when he talked about Malcolm X and Coltrane, he said that both men perceived the reality of the United States, a reality you could only know if you were black and had worked your way up through the tangled jungle of jazz, clubs, narcotics, alcohol, and mobsters. And then talked about how these both men were accustomed to certain ways of thinking and freeing themselves of being held down by and constrained by the conventional standard thinking and assumptions of a kind of larger white world in America and broke through that. And even though both men, in some senses, gave themselves lives of comfort on some levels, they were way beyond that and pushing the envelope for the rest of us to come in and understand what's been hidden. Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, that's beautiful, Mark. Mm-hmm. I think I believe that too. I also think that the achievement that Coltrane had, you know, he spent hours and hours practicing without that's making a sound in the quiet of his little small apartment just to perfect his craft. But what he expressed in A Love Supreme is, I think, or I want to believe, is what all of us want, and that is the ability to strive to excellence and to allow God to move us to a point of excellence through striving that others can see that excellence. Mm-hmm. And right now, we can still see the excellence of John Coltrane in Love Supreme, and it stands as an example in this craft of what we call jazz, that is the jazz idiom. It's the expression of that jazz musician, John Coltrane, and his quintet, that today is still the most recognizable, I think, recorded achievement.
Yeah. Yeah,
in appreciation of the striving towards goodness and towards God.
Yeah. I think so. I think that what he did was, what you know, no matter what you come up with, the first thing you think about, you know, during that period, a lot of that had to do with entertainment. Okay, but John Coltrane was coming with the reality of art as it's supposed to be. You know, the reflection of life, the talk about what you see in the future. You know, what you've been through. And he sort of brought that out right to you with sound. And the sound described everything, you know what I mean? You know,
I think I want to add to those listeners who might be out there that have not yet experienced the Love Supreme, get your earphones and go into a nice quiet room and listen to it. And I'm almost willing to guarantee you will come out feeling better spiritually as a human being as a result of that experience. Yeah. And that's the power of that music.
Yeah.
Santana, I was reading the autobiography of Santana.
Right.
Santana also said it had the same effect on him. Jimi Hendrix, the same effect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can go on through. It's not just a jazz musician that's going to appreciate this. It's the human being that's going to appreciate this excellence. Yeah.
So, you know, when we look at this, it also seems to me that you hear and listen to John Coltrane and watch what he went through and the changes he's gone through over the years and what led to Love Supreme. And one of the things I was thinking about is, like, I felt like he went through really these three periods of jazz associations. Maybe I have this wrong, but let me
three
throw this out.
I feel you.
Let me throw it out and see what y'all think. One was when he was going between Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk.
Okay.
Right? And he was really close to Monk, but he couldn't get that close to Miles Davis because nobody could, I think. But, but he was going between them. Then came the McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But then the group with his music kind of went someplace, and they really didn't stay hip to some of the stuff he was doing. It was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And he got into this Archie Shepp-Pharoah Saunders period, right?
He did, didn't he?
Right?
Yes.
So, I mean, he really kind of went through and then left us at 40.
Yeah.
At 40.
Yeah.
Liver cancer. I think that was probably directly related to the drug use he had when he was young.
Mm.
But, I mean, that seemed to be... He
was leave out Eric Dolphy.
Right.
I think Nasser Abadeh would agree with me that out of all of the sidemen, and I think this is a little prejudicial... But Elvin Jones had the most effect on him as a fellow musician that helped catapult him into where he wanted to be spiritually and musically.
He pushed him there.
Literally.
It got to a point.
Because of the power of the drum. Elvin had a mastery over the polyrhythms.
That's right.
In a sense that the tribal Africans did. And that you have to remember, 64 was when Olatunji.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Olatunji came out with drums
of passion.
So this is the relevance of the drum as a foundation for the development. Elvin epitomized that. I'm going to let Nasser pick up because I know he's
good. Go ahead, man.
I totally agree with that. I'll go back and state what I learned from Max Roach is that every time there was an advancement in the music, it is when the leader of the band allowed the drummer to come up with his own part.
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead, Nas.
And so when you look back over the period of the development of this music, you go back all the way to the top, and you see Baby God. They changed it. And then you see with Duke Ellington, with Sonny Greer.
And with
Count Basie, with Papa Joe Jones.
That's right.
You know, and you move on up the line.
Big Sid.
Big Sid.
Chano Puzzle.
With Diz and Charlie Parker, you had Max Roach,
yes.
Kenny Clarke, who changed it. And then along comes, you know, John Coltrane with Elvin Jones.
Let's listen for a minute.
That's Elvin Jones right there.
Elvin's right here.
And of course, later on, Miles with Tony, and it goes on and on.
Yeah.
But Elvin was the first drummer that I heard that grabbed my ear, because I listened to Opry, I listened to Max Roach, but it was listening to John Coltrane that led me to Elvin, and I couldn't understand what he was doing until later I got that, basically, and Hank Jones said this about his brother. I had an opportunity to play with Hank. I asked him about his brother. He said Elvin always played that way. He always had a way of listening to African rhythms and sort of putting them in a context within swing. All the nuances of independency of each limb, and working his way through any music he played based upon the triplet. And I also go back to a conversation I have with Antoine Roney, who played with Elvin for a few years. And he said that he went to Africa with Elvin. And when Elvin got there, all these djembe drummers showed up, and they created a circle around him, and they played together. He sent me a picture of this event, and he also recorded it. I have not heard the recording, but when you look at the picture, you see the same kind of energy surrounded Elvin that surrounded Pops. Louis Armstrong, when he first went to Africa.
And I have to say, and I have to give a big thank you to Mark Steiner, because we are not just jazz musicians or appreciators of this art that are coming on talking about one of our heroes. I think what I'm trying to express is that if there's anybody in the sound of this broadcast that has not experienced Love Supreme, you need to get an unbiased chance to experience, because this is not just some small group of people talking about the hero. This is a music that will change your life if you give it a chance to listen to it. And
right.
I appreciate you, Mark Steiner, for giving us the opportunity to show our appreciation for it.
I think that there's so much that we have to learn, I think, about our history and what music does to our history and how it can change things. That's why I mentioned Beethoven's Eroica earlier in the program, connecting it to this piece. And it's also that you know, we are in a very special moment in American history. We're facing things right now where the explosion of the notion of race, again, is exploding onto America, as it should. And it's, to me, it's the next level of struggle to change America and to change the world. We're in the midst of another one right now after those that some of us here in this room lived through in the 60s. And I think that John Coltrane was the embodiment of that in many ways by music. And I think that he was one of the great embodiments of music in that way. And I this afternoon at 3 o'clock, bass is going to be playing the entire suite, all four parts, in the groove. So he'll be able to hear that after 3 o'clock today.
So
I would encourage to take this piece of music, a piece of music you do need to sit and take and just listen to.
Yeah.
It can be part of your morning meditation. It can be whatever you want it to be. You can walk in the woods and put it on your head. You can just sit in your living room and just sit, whatever.
You're exactly right. And we're trying to emphasize the importance that music has in bringing about social change. And I think we recognize that in the 60s and 64 when this was recorded, and how it brought people a greater consciousness and a greater sense of achievement and a desire to do the right thing. Yeah. And I think that this time today is no different.
You can comment on this one. I'm going to read these two quotes and see what you all think. We have like 9 minutes left before we have a pre-recorded piece by one of my producers who fell in love with Coltrane and did a piece on the latest re-release of his work. We'll be hearing in a couple of minutes. But Archie Shepp said in 1968, we're only an extension of that entire civil rights black Muslim, black nationalist movement that is taking place in America. This is fundamental music. His saxophone, Shep added, was like a machine gun in the hands of the Viet Cong.
I remember reading that.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, again, going back to Frankowski, I pulled the book off my shelf this morning. I've had it since 1970. He said, music is an expression of higher ideals. Brotherhood is there, and I believe with brotherhood there would be no poverty. There would be no war. I know that there are bad forces. Forces put here that bring suffering to others and misery to the world, but I want to be a force which is truly good. And that's what jazz is.
That's what jazz is. Right? That's what the Love Supreme is.
And so
You know, Archie Shepp was brought in to the next day to record Love Supreme, but the they wanted the original take, so they went with the original one anyway.
Really?
Yeah. Archie Shepp came and recorded with him on the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Same suite.
That's right. Yeah.
It's a great thing. The music is so great that it helps us to change. And again, I really appreciate the opportunity to share my appreciation.
I think that I'm glad the bass is going to be playing that this afternoon, the whole piece through. And I think that you can also see. And the time we have left, about 7 minutes in this particular episode, that talk a bit about Coltrane and his journey. I mean, he went through so much, you know, but coming out of the Navy and into the jazz scene, falling into his heroin thing, falling in love with Naima, and then
Alice. Stepping off. Yeah.
You know,
that's
right.
And how his world began to open. Mm-hmm. He was such a deep thinker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
and feeler.
Yes, yes, he was. And what I over the years have noticed, I go all the way back, and I think about the fact that John Coltrane was raised as a Baptist.
That's right.
And he had a sense of religion that was that he grew up with, and his love for God, just the idea. I have an anecdote for you. My mother-in-law, who left us in 2010 at the age of 96, she was a vocalist, and she came up in the era of the big band era, you know, and so she could not understand. Sometimes she'd be in the car with us, with her daughter and me, and we'd be on long drives, and we'd have John Coltrane on, and she said, you know, it just sounds like that everybody's playing together, and I mean that they're playing solos, that they're not playing together.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got to Love Supreme, I mentioned to her about the poem, and I gave her the poem to read as the last song played, and then she got it. It was so interesting that she really got John's commitment and his intention with the music. And so all of that says to me that he went full circle. He went from his upbringing in the church, and then later on his music became reflective of his earlier years of development. And so all that he went through, the drugs, the alcohol, and other things that he sort of put to the side at one point in his life and committed himself to the testament of God, that is a tremendous journey. That is a tremendous journey.
You know, I agree. You know what's so interesting about it? And you mentioned the Baptist church. I know his people were somewhat Pentecostal.
And they were all saying his grandfather was AME minister.
Yeah, yeah.
And what really got
me was the fact that all the they call it travailing or shouting or whatever that you experience in that, or when they say you have the Holy Ghost. If you notice, and I know you guys agree with me, the transfer to that, to the music, and that's a part of the embodiment of the stuff we come to call jazz. You remember it was hot. It was, you know, it became hotter, you know, that sort of thing, and it became more spiritual, and that was all the journey. That journey he went through all that music, you know. I think in his life itself, you know.
So let me jump in. I say that Marcellus has jumped in. We have like 4 minutes before we want to play Mark Gunnery's piece, but please jump in.
Not to take away from anything in this conversation, because it's been amazing. I was just sitting there listening, and I felt that I needed to share the most important piece to me of A Love Supreme. It is the very first thing that you hear, that Chinese gong.
Yeah,
that's right.
You're right. You got it.
It vibrates. Oh, yeah. It goes out. It sends out vibrations that I think just hit the entire world. I mean, if you could visualize that gong and see the vibration coming off of that thing, and then that first note hits. And it just takes you there.
It does. You know, he was so deeply moved by Eastern culture, Eastern religion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Learn how
to
play the sitar.
Mysticism.
His deep conversations with Ravi Shankar. You know, he was so universal in his thinking about the world. You know, and that gong thing, I never thought about it like that.
It's a very unorthodox recording, but I mean, it hits, and it just you could see that thing just vibrating, and all that energy just being pushed out there. Yeah, and those four guys, it's like the planets just aligning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every one of them
came together in that recording session.
That's really interesting.
And if you go back and listen, you will all, throughout the whole suite, you hear the blues.
Yeah.
Right. You're exactly right. Yeah.
And I he was the I mean, if it was one thing that Coltrane means to me, it was his, as we have to close here, he embodied to me the new America of all the pieces coming together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
as it it's there.
Because jazz is our classical music. Right. Mm-hmm. He was the embodiment that exploded that like Beethoven did 200 years before him in Europe with their classical music. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like this is, he was one of the most important figures, I think. And when Mark Gunnery came up to me, and one of my producers, and said, Love Supreme's anniversary is coming up. Can we do this? He just bought the new album.
He was excited about it.
He was excited about it. So can we produce this? I said, yeah, we should do this. So he produces this episode. And an episode, just like Coltrane and Jazz, and my show often, I come in prepared, but then I just let it roll, see where we're going to go. Yeah. And just as it rolled, Shaheed rolled in here, not supposed to be a guest, but we wanted him at the last second. Come on in. And Nasr Abadeh called in. We weren't sure he was coming. He's here, so we let it roll. And bass walks in at the end. That's jazz. Mm. That's Coltrane. Yeah. That's us.
Yeah. And that's WEA.
And that's WEA. Right. So Nasr Abadeh, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, and I enjoyed this morning's chat with you gentlemen, and I hope you have a pleasant day.
You too.
You too, Nasr.
And Doc Manning, Robert Shaheed, thank you for all you bring to this community with life and love. Good to have and your music.
It's an honor to be
and
with you,
Marcella Shepard, as well, obviously.
Thank you for letting me crash the party.
I bet you crashed the party. All right.